Usually when you step into a completely quiet, empty room, there's this expectation of just profound peace, like it's a blank canvas.
Right. There's absolutely nothing there but the walls, the floor, and the silence.
Exactly. It is, by all accounts, just objective reality. But then you turn off the lights, and suddenly that blank canvas isn't so blank anymore.
It never is it?
No. It gets filled with shadows and strange shapes and this overwhelming, deafening internal noise that, frankly, just wasn't there 2 seconds ago.
Yeah.
And the physical room didn't change at all, but we did.
Yeah, it's the absolute definition of manufacturing your own haunting. I mean, we take an objective emptiness and we immediately populate it with our own dread. We're just projecting a script onto the silent.
Which is exactly the phenomenon we are unpacking in today's deep dive. We're looking at a really reflective personal essay published today, August 17th, 2026,
Yeah.
by Keane Akintayo, and it's titled The Ghosts We Author Ourselves.
That's a fantastic piece.
It really is. And our mission today for you, the listener, is to examine how our minds manufacture these intense personal fears, right?
Yeah.
Pulling from external stories and childhood myths and essentially turning peaceful realities into, well, horror shows.
Yeah, it can essentially holds up a mirror to how our irrational, noisy mental scripts are constantly clashing with peaceful, objective realities. And, he uses cemeteries as the ultimate illustration of this clash.
Oh, cemeteries are the perfect example for this. Because, I mean, by any rational objective measure, a cemetery is one of the most peaceful, quiet, still places on the face of the earth.
Well, it's a space given over entirely to rest.
Right. The ground itself is not emitting any sort of terror. There's no, like, biological frequency of fear radiating from the soil. The environment is entirely benign.
And yet, human beings collectively take this absolute stillness and we fill it with deafening anxiety. We bring the noise with us. The anxiety isn't in the earth. It's a lens we wear when we look at the earth.
Which brings up the core question of Akin's essay, which is, where exactly is that noise coming from? Because it doesn't spontaneously generate.
No, it certainly doesn't.
It's a script we are handed. And Akin writes from the perspective of an anxious, highly imaginative adult. He openly describes having this impressionable mind that has, in the past, conjured up dreadful, invisible apparitions that he actually still finds difficult to even talk about today.
Yeah, he recognizes that his mind is so adept at visualization that it just doesn't need external stimuli. And because of this, he actively avoids horror films or really any triggers that invite paranormal suggestion.
Because his brain doesn't need a prompt to start directing a horror movie.
Exactly, it's already rolling the cameras.
I always think of the brain in these situations like a really aggressive, predictive text algorithm. When you're texting, you leave a sentence hanging and the algorithm tries to guess the next word based on patterns it's learned.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right. So when you step into a dark room or a silent cemetery, your brain's predictive text algorithm is suddenly operating in a total vacuum. It has no visual data to work with.
Left.
So it just starts auto-filling the silence with the worst-case scenarios it has in its database.
That predictive algorithm analogy actually explains the evolutionary mechanics perfectly. I mean, the human brain evolved to be an overactive pattern recognition engine.
Which kept us alive.
Exactly. From a survival standpoint, when our ancestors stepped into the dark unknown, the brain craved information to ensure safety. So if there is no information, if it's just silence, the unchecked imagination kicks in to fill the void.
Better safe than sorry,
Wow.
basically.
To the primitive parts of our brain, a known threat, even a fictional one, feels more manageable than the sheer, unmapped uncertainty of nothingness.
And Akin actually describes this as a state of, quote, sheer willing victimhood, which is such a powerful phrase. We willingly cast ourselves as the victim in a horror movie of our own making simply because predicting a ghost feels less cognitively dissonant than sitting peacefully with the unknown.
It really is wild. But, that database of worst-case scenarios, the patterns the predictive text is drawing from, they aren't innate.
Right. We aren't born with them.
Exactly. Akin points out that we fear the peaceful dead entirely because of cultural fables, the tales of ghosts and ghouls and banshees that we absorbed long before we were old enough to analyze them critically.
It's like downloading a malicious background software when you're a kid. We absorb these stories before the rational filter in our prefrontal cortex is fully built.
Yes, the firewall isn't up yet.
Perfect way to put it. We take in this narrative that the dark is full of monsters, and because we don't have the cognitive architecture to say, wait, scientifically, banshees don't exist, It just gets written directly into our foundational operating system.
And the caregivers and the culture passing down these myths, they usually intend them as harmless campfire tales, right? Or, you know, even tools to keep kids from wandering off at night.
Like, don't go into the woods or the bogeyman will get you.
Right. But to an impressionable mind, those stories become undeniable truths about how the physical world operates when the lights go out. You essentially internalize a cultural superstition as a biological fact.
Which really makes you wonder about the adults who know better.
Mm.
Because, I mean, we grow up, we develop that prefrontal cortex. We know logically that these are just stories written by other hands. So why does the adult brain still default to terrifying fiction?
Well, it's because those neural pathways were laid down during crucial developmental windows. Even when your adult logical brain knows a ghost story is fiction, the older, deeper parts of your nervous system still treat the associated cues as existential threats.
So the cultural script actually hijacks your biology.
Completely. And Aiken illustrates this beautifully with the concept of the fake tombstone effect.
Oh, this part is fascinating. So Aiken presents this thought experiment to the reader. Just imagine someone plants a tombstone in the ground. Purely as a prank.
Right. There is absolutely nothing buried beneath it.
Nothing. No remains, no history. It is literally just a piece of rock carved into a specific shape, sitting in the dirt.
But if you walk past that fake tombstone at night and your imagination readily runs wild, that inert rock will exert the full terrifying graveyard effect on you.
You will have a full-blown biological panic response. I mean, think about that. Your heart rate will spike. Your palms will sweat. Your pupils will dilate to take in more light. Your body is literally preparing to fight or flee for its life, all because of the shape of a rock.
It is a profound example of the nocebo effect, which is the dark sibling of the placebo effect.
Right. The placebo effect being when you take a sugar pill and get better.
Exactly. We know that if a patient believes a sugar pill is a powerful medicine, their brain can trigger real physiological healing cascades.
Yep.
The expectation creates reality. Well, the fake tombstone is a nocebo.
So the expectation creates a negative reality.
Exactly. The shape of the rock is the sugar pill. It has absolutely no intrinsic supernatural power.
But because your cultural software strongly associates that specific shape with ghosts and ghouls, your visual cortex sees the shape and sends an immediate alarm to the amygdala.
And the amygdala doesn't wait for your rational brain to verify if the rock is dangerous. It instantly dumps adrenaline and cortisol into your bloodstream.
It's just reacting.
Right. Your mind expects terror, so your body obediently manufactures the physiological reality of terror out of thin air. It is absolute proof that the dread lives entirely in the mind of the beholder, not in the physical stone or the earth.
So we have this incredibly powerful, albeit very misguided, biological machinery. We are essentially using our own nervous systems to scare ourselves half to death over empty space.
Yeah, we really are.
So the obvious question Ekin then tackles is, how do we stop doing this? I mean, how do we rewrite the script and stop casting ourselves as the victims of our own fantasies when the lights go out?
Well, he outlines two distinct actionable interventions for combating these fears. The first is physical boundary setting, and the second is logical deduction.
Okay, let's break those down.
So the physical approach is really about managing the environmental triggers before the amygdala can even hijack the system.
And he gives a very practical example from his own life here. He talks about how back in March, he was living in a seventh-floor apartment that happened to overlook a Jewish cemetery.
Which, for an anxious, highly imaginative adult, is basically living next door to a massive nocebo factory.
Seriously, the visual cue of the cemetery is just constantly offering a prompt to his predictive text algorithm.
Exactly. So what did he do? Once it grew dark, he would actively draw the curtains and close the windows. He simply refused to let the avoidance of the unknown take hold.
It's so simple, but so effective.
It really is. By drawing the curtains, he's removing the visual data that triggers the inherited cultural script. If the eyes don't see the tombstones, the amygdala doesn't sound the alarm.
Out of sight, out of mind. Literally.
Literally. It is a vital strategy. If you know your mind is highly susceptible to suggestion, you have to be rigorous about guarding your physical environment.
But, you know, drawing the curtains only works when you are inside your own apartment. You can't just draw curtains over the whole world.
Right, you have to go outside eventually.
Exactly. And that's where Aiken's second intervention comes in, which is deeply internal. He uses logical deduction to essentially interrogate his own anxiety.
Yes. He looks at the cemetery and starts breaking down the logic of his fear. He notes that he has no association with these graves. He has no shared history with the people buried there, no bond, no connection whatsoever.
And he asks this incredibly sharp, almost humorous question. If I have absolutely no connection to these people, why on earth would the dead take the slightest interest in me?
It forces a confrontation with the narcissism of our own anxiety, doesn't it?
Narcissism of anxiety, that is exactly what it is. We assume that if there are ghosts, they must be obsessed with us. Like, we assume these strangers from a different century are going to go out of their way, abandon whatever they're doing in the afterlife, just to cast you as the leading player in a horror film, while they relegate themselves to the supporting cast.
It's really kind of arrogant when you think about it. When you apply rational deduction, you realize how mathematically absurd the fear is.
Totally.
You are simply not that important to the deceased. Akin concludes that the least association should leave no true affinity, and therefore no logical reason for fear. Put plainly, less connection equates to a weaker hold on the imagination.
Okay, I have to push back on this a little bit, though.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I read that part of the essay and thought, you know, this is fantastic daytime logic.
Daytime logic, right.
Yeah. When the sun is shining and you are sitting in a coffee shop, it is very easy to intellectually dismantle the narcissism of anxiety. It makes perfect sense. But intellectualizing our fears is notoriously flimsy in the dark.
Oh, absolutely. The transition from daytime logic to nighttime courage is the ultimate bottleneck in overcoming anxiety. As we discussed, the fear response lives in the older, faster parts of the brain. The logical deduction Akin is using lives in the slower prefrontal cortex.
The amygdala is always going to outpace the prefrontal cortex. Always. So when you are out there in the dark and your heart is pounding, can rational thinking actually override an overactive imagination that is currently flooding your body with adrenaline?
Well, the text gives us the perfect real-world scenario to test that exact friction. The ultimate trial of Akin's logic occurs during a late-night encounter.
Right. So to set the scene, Akin is out on a walk late at night, and unwittingly, he wanders past this disused, unkempt cemetery located right between a road junction and a cluster of residences.
It's exactly the kind of setting that triggers every cultural fable we've talked about.
Every single one. The graves are untended, the lighting is poor, it's late.
Every environmental cue is signaling his brain to initiate the nocebo effect.
And his mind immediately does. It triggers a heightened state of anxiety. He is actively expecting to see a supernatural sight. He's dreading it. He notes that the power of mental suggestion is just firing on all cylinders. His biology is telling him to run.
This is the internal war happening in real time. You know, the primitive brain is sounding the alarm, trying to cast him as the victim. But his rational mind is fighting back, insisting there is no logical reason to run.
He's desperately trying to deploy that daytime logic we just talked about. The whole I have no connection to these graves thing.
Exactly. But the crucial thing here is that the intellectualizing hasn't magically stopped his heart from racing.
No, the fear is still very physically present.
Right. However, the logic does give him something else. It gives him the resolve to not flee. He makes a conscious choice to stand his ground. He decides that if he is confronted with anything, he will engage with it rather than letting the predictive text algorithm write the ending.
And that decision to stand ground is a massive cognitive shift. He is refusing the sheer willing victimhood. He is forcing his prefrontal cortex to stay online despite the adrenaline.
And it's a very good thing he does, because suddenly the inciting incident happens. Out of the recesses of a nearby building, a figure emerges in the dark.
Oh, man. For an anxious mind already primed by a cemetery, a figure stepping out of the shadows is the absolute worst-case scenario.
The imagination immediately labels it a ghost, a ghoul, a massive threat.
But then the figure steps out and simply says, hello.
Just hello. And because Akin had already made the commitment to stand his ground, he is able to process this moment differently.
He notes explicitly that he had the presence of mind not to, quote, jump out of his skin. He gives himself a crucial split second to actually process the visual data coming in rather than just reacting to the mental script.
He pauses the movie his brain was directing.
Exactly. And as he makes sense of the situation, the reality snaps into focus. It's a homeless man.
It is not a ghost risen from the grave. It is a living, breathing human being simply occupying the space.
Just a guy. And Akin has this profound realization as the adrenaline crashes. He contrasts this grounded reality with the soaring anxiety he felt just moments before.
The contrast is jarring.
It really is. He realizes that the actual encounter with a living person, even a startling one in the dark, was nowhere near as bad as the horrific horrors his mind had imagined.
The fiction was infinitely worse than the fact. Grounded reality has rules, boundaries, and logic. The internal world of an unchecked imagination has no bounds. It can invent infinite torment.
Right.
But when you actually stand your ground and force your brain to look at the objective reality, the terrifying unknown usually just says, hello.
I love that. And reclaiming our rational sense of peace really requires us to actively unlearn these superstitions by doing exactly what Akin did. We have to let reality prove our anxieties wrong over and over again until that old cultural software is finally uninstalled.
You have to expose the predictive text algorithm to actual data rather than letting it run in a vacuum. Once you dismantle the fables, you can finally see the cemetery for what it objectively is. A peaceful place of rest, entirely indifferent to your presence.
So when you distill the key takeaways from Akin's experience across this deep dive, it really challenges how we walk through the world. I mean, first, your dread of the unknown is almost always an inherited narrative.
Yes, it is a script someone else handed you.
Second, the places we fear are often objectively places of peace, corrupted only by the deafening internal noise we bring with us.
Mm-hmm.
And third, the physical reality of a situation is rarely as terrifying as the ghosts we author ourselves.
It is a realization that demands we take back the pen. We have to stop letting inherited folklore and overactive amygdalas write the scripts of our emotional lives.
Absolutely. So I want you, the listener, to take a moment and reflect on your own life today. Where are you planting fake tombstones in your own mind?
That's the real question.
What are the horror scripts written by other hands that you are currently acting out? Because look, it might not be a literal graveyard for you. It might be a new project in your career. It might be a difficult conversation in a relationship. Or it might just be your daily ambient anxieties about the future.
Are you casting yourself as the victim in a disaster scenario that exists entirely in your own imagination?
It is remarkably easy to let an impressionable mind build a haunted house out of a totally normal Tuesday. You feel the anxiety, so you assume the threat is real.
But once you recognize the nocebo effect of your own dread, once you realize your body is reacting to a shape, not a threat, you gain the power to dismantle it. You can draw the curtains. You can interrogate the logic. You can stand your ground.
Which brings me to a final, slightly provocative thought I want you to mull over on your own. It builds on the mechanics of everything Akin showed us today.
Okay, let's hear it.
We spend this entire time talking about the negative power of the mind, how it uses this incredible machinery to scare us. But think about the underlying mechanism itself. If our minds possess the raw, unbelievable creative power to vividly hallucinate our worst fears to the point of triggering real biological panic based entirely on old fables, what might happen if we consciously flip the script?
Oh, that's interesting, because the mechanism itself is completely neutral. The predictive text algorithm is just a tool. It only uses the data it is given.
Exactly. What if we consciously trained our active imaginations to vividly author scripts of profound wonder, safety, and curiosity in those exact same unknown spaces? If your mind has the raw power to invent a monster out of shadows and spike your heart rate, it possesses the exact same power to invent a miracle and flood your body with calm.
You are using the exact same mental muscle, but you are choosing to apply it toward hope instead of horror. You're writing a different ending to the silence.
So the next time you step into that completely quiet, empty room and the lights go out, remember that the blank canvas is yours. The physical room didn't change.
Yeah.
But you get to decide what you project into the dark.